Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I am your host, Chris George Zuger, and you have entered the Den of Lore. Please pull your chair up to the fire, grab your glass of scotch, and we are going to learn some cool shit, really cool shit tonight, courtesy of none other than Zeke Smith of Survivor fame, who is live here in studio in our brand new version 2.0. Zeke, welcome to the program. It is a pleasure to have you. Cheers to you.
Cheers to you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure.
I was under the impression that we were doing a podcast about cool shit and not that we were shooting some sort of space pornography. The music has led me to believe it is more space pornography.
We can do that, but I know you've got to talk about 2.5 hours, and I want to make sure you can get there on time.
All right.
So please, if you like the program, don't forget to subscribe to the channel. Go check out our iTunes. I know that we're a little bit behind on the audio channels, but I will guarantee on penalty of death that I will have it all out up to date on Tuesday, because I've been building this, ladies and gentlemen. I just need to make sure I've got the right one selected there. Pshaw! Version Studio 2.0. So, again, you can understand why there's been a little bit of a delay in the audio. I've been working on some major construction. Here we are.
And the new studio even comes with a dog.
He does, yes. Tyson is known to the denizens. And he is probably the most adorable thing besides Coco that comes in here, and he's gonna ask for pets all show.
I'll gladly oblige.
Oh, you know, that's fantastic, because you've got a best friend for life. If you ever come back here, come back for him.
Might just take him with me. Maybe Jason's gonna be mine.
I would say please do, but he's also adorable, and he's very warm.
Yes, it's true.
Now, but before we get to it, I need to thank our... Oh, thank you very much for opening up my vape pen, Tyson. That's appreciated. Tyson, why don't you go lay down? Go lay down. Good boy. I have to thank our patrons. They're the reason that we stay on the air, because as all of you out there know, we do not, and coming from an advertising background, this is very strange for me to be able to say, Zeke, we do not take corporate sponsorship. We do not do commercials, except for the commercial at the beginning of the show. And that's so we can say whatever the fuck we want on this channel. So again, if you don't hold back.
Oh, this will be no holds barred.
No holds barred.
You're gonna want, your ears will be bleeding by the end of this.
Oh, this will be awesome. I can't wait. I'll have to clean out these earphones afterwards for the next show next week. For specifically to our masters, Kevin Fothy, Antonio Martinez, Frederick Johnson, Jared Thompson, Mrs. Fox, Roses, Wayne, Joshua E. Manic, and El McCurdy, thank you very much. And also to Mark Catalano, you're the guys are the reasons why this studio exists. And also to Matthew Toth, Vinice from Magical Egypt, Sentient, Michael Eckhoff, Dean John Kenrod, as well as to Hobby. Thank you very much for all of your contributions to the Den of Lore. You're the reason why I do this, and the reason why we love doing what we do, and why we can stay so awesome. And Tyson is looking for more pets. I think he wants to come on the couch, but I can't have him on here. There's no room.
There's room at the end, Tyson.
There is. So, Zeke, I'm just going to read your quick bio out here. Don't read the bio from, I should say, what was the drive down here? Fan pages can be a little bit weird sometimes.
Yeah, well, I would say not necessarily accurate.
Okay.
nor am I, like, well-liked by the kind of hardcore Survivor fan. Yeah, no, I for some reason, they deplore me. So I can't vouch for it.
Okay, well, I'll read this. I try to stay factual on this one.
Great.
Zeke became one of the main characters in Millennials versus Gen X with his progressive strategy and with his flamboyant personality, which is probably one of the reasons why we got along so well.
Yeah, there you go.
He eventually led his own alliance, who helped him get to the final nine, where he was finally blindsided by Will Wall, who, coincidentally enough, was, you know, kicked out the next
tribal council. Yeah, it was not, and I was like, Will, this is not smart. This is not going to be a good move for you, which is why I kind of didn't think he was going to do it. I was like, we can all just see this, it would be terrible. And then he got voted out, and I got voted out, and then he got voted out, and then we were roommates at Ponderosa, which is where you're sent after you're voted out.
I have to talk. I've never watched the Ponderosa web series on that, but we'll talk about that in a bit.
Totally.
Now, Zeke was also a main character in Game Changers, which is one of my favorite seasons of all time, where he continued to prove his strategic prowess in successfully voting out Sandra
Diaz-Twine.
Diaz-Twine. I always say whenever I butcher a name, please take a shot. Zeke is a particularly impactful encounter with Jeff Varner that altered Zeke's attitude to the game, leaving him to make the rash decision to turn on his closest allies, Siri Fields and Andrea
Belki.
Belki. It's a good thing we're not doing a mailbag this episode because, oh man. Leading to his eventual blindside due to his perceived untrustworthiness. Zeke, well, you know, I've spent the last hour with you. You know, trustworthy? I'd say you're an okay dude.
Well, I would say that, you know, the tricky thing about the post-merge of me on Game Changers is that, like, nobody, after what happened, nobody was going to let me get anywhere near the end, right? Like, I was playing a game that was unwinnable. So, you know, people sometimes don't understand what I did, but it's really hard to be playing Survivor when other people don't want to play with you. You just know that your time is so limited. So I was just trying to do whatever I could do to make a splash before I left.
Now, one of the big things that came out of the last season, and, you know, I'm one of those jump right into it type of things.
Let's do it.
Okay, so you've been doing a lot of work with GLAAD, and this was based off of your...
My grand public outing?
Well, okay, I like to be able to term it as the only tribal counselor where Jeff kicked someone out of the show, essentially.
Yeah.
But you've turned it into one of the most positive, empowering things that I've ever seen.
Thank you.
And I have to say, you've been... I'm trying to say, like, we're different shows. I'm not trying to ask you the millionth question that you've had the exact same way from the average reporter. So, when that was going down, was it more like, are you really fucking doing this right now? Like, what was your, how, I'm gonna say, like, what was your internal reaction? Like, your honest to God reaction on that?
Yeah. Well, I had no idea that it was gonna happen, and we were just sitting there, and, you know, I guess first is I was playing my second consecutive season of Survivor. Mm-hmm. So I played my first season, got voted out. 20 minutes later, Jeff Probst said, want to do it again in 2 weeks.
Oh my God.
And so I had 2 weeks, and then I was back in Brooklyn for 2 weeks, and then I jumped off a boat into the Fijian Sea and did it all over again. And when it happened, I think my first reaction was like, run. Like leave, exit the space. Like the lights got really bright. Like I felt like the cameras were right there in my face. Like I was really scared, and I sort of had this like instinctual flight response. And then that got better when I heard that like everyone else around me like rose up into my defense, right? Like Probst was on it. All my other tribe mates, they were like, I didn't have to be angry or explain why what happened was wrong, because they sort of handled that for me. And then I kind of, like, so before I went on Survivor, I knew there was a chance that, like, my being trans could be something that was discussed. Either me bringing it up or someone else bringing it up. I think I imagined all of the ways in which it could happen. And, like, the way it happened, it sort of did. I was like, oh, yeah, like, it could happen in a really bad way. But I was like, probably. Like, who would do that? Who would do it in, like, such an asshole way? And so I'd planned a response, like, but months before I went out there, and it wasn't necessarily that I'd planned out what I was going to say, but I knew that I needed to stay calm, mm-hmm. and that I needed to be like, guys, we're fine, like, everything's okay. But that it happened in such, like, a terrible way, I think I had to take, because if you watch it, I'm, like, checked out for a while. I'm just sort of, like, staring off into space. And I'm having this internal conversation with myself that's like, okay, you remember the plan. The plan is to stay calm. And you also have to figure out what the hell you're going to say. Because this is a moment. Like, this is going to be huge. Like, I felt the weight of everything that was going to happen right then. And was like, you need to conduct yourself in a way that is becoming, like, the gravity of this moment. And that probably means you shouldn't just go run out of tribal council right now.
Now, has that actually, like, not saying that you've done that, but has that actually happened where somebody's actually run out of tribal council before?
No, I don't think anyone's just ever jetted out of tribal. But I mean, you're under, you know, Survivor is very close to being in prison. Like, you know, you're separated from, like, the first thing you do when you arrive in Los Angeles before they send you out to a place that they don't tell you where you're going. You can figure it out online, but no one tells you that you're going to Fiji. You arrive in Los Angeles, the first thing they do is take your phone away and they put you in a room by yourself for 24 hours.
Oh God.
And then they put you on a plane and you're not, and you're with your other tribe mates for, or your castmates, 4 or 5 or 6 days, but you're not allowed to talk to each other. So the only people you can talk to are people involved with the show, and no one ever tells you anything that's going on. So no one tells you the day that, like, you're gonna go start playing Survivor. No one tells you where you're going. Like, you don't even know that you're gonna go to a challenge until someone says, all right, we're gonna lock it down, no more talking, we're gonna put you on a boat and take you to a challenge. So you are under total control intentionally so that you wouldn't go do something like run out of tribal council. But in that moment, I think the rule, everything was just so suspended that it really felt like an option for me.
Now, how, I'm going to say the, like, advocacy is one of the things we do here on the Den of Lore. It's near and dear to our hearts. You know, charity is kind of the big thing we always try and push with helping the community, trying to make the community better. How did you get approached afterwards to do work with the community, with the LGBTQ community?
Well, I would say I was the one who did the approaching, because I knew that if, like, you know, trans people, and I would say in particular trans men, are pretty invisible on national media platforms, or say international media platforms. And I knew that if my being trans was ever part of my Survivor story, that I would incur a responsibility to my community to become an advocate, which is not exactly what I was looking to do. I was just sort of happy to go on about my life the way that it was. But we had this, you know, we had this moment, and I felt like before I went on Survivor, one of my big goals was there are so many sad trans stories, so many trans stories with sad endings, and I didn't want that to be mine. So I had something bad happen to me, and I was pretty damn determined to turn it into something positive, to reclaim the narrative, for the story not to be Zeke was outed, but, like, Zeke went on this grand adventure and learned so much about himself that when he was put in a really difficult situation, he rose above and was able to make a positive impact in the world.
And just before I go on to the next question, I'm noticing in the camera, and this is probably my fault because I positioned it improperly, just take it and move it back about. You should just be able to scissor up.
Can we do it like this?
Oh, you can, yeah, totally.
Is that better?
Just give me a second here. You know, I could see perfect. Fantastic.
Is that? There you go.
I see Joe Rogan do that all the time. I'm like, I can do this. It's fine. What is some of the work you've been doing lately?
Sure. So I guess what the, you know, the crazy part of the story is that, you know, I play Survivor. It happens. I play Survivor a little more. I get voted out. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, well, what? And Jeff Probst and I start having conversations in Fiji. And I'm like, what the hell am I going to say? Like, what am I supposed to say? Like, what am I supposed to say? I now have to speak for a group of people. And I think if you were to speak for all podcasters or be in that position, you're like, well, what the hell do you say, right? What can I say that's relevant and impactful? And I was put in touch with Nick Adams, who is the director of the transgender media program at GLAAD. And, you know, I thought Nick was going to tell me what to say, right? I thought someone along the way would just say, this is what you have to say. This is what you're supposed to say. But no, that's not how it happens. You have to figure out what you want to say. Which is a pretty scary proposition. But that is not answering your question. So I do a couple of things with GLAAD. I'm involved with fundraising efforts, which is, I like to think, it is paying back the money for the time and resources that GLAAD spent pouring into me to teach me how to be a responsible advocate for trans people, because I was not before. Like, I had to be put through this course of, like, just being trans doesn't make you, like, good at advocating for trans people, which I think there are certain, you know, trans celebrities in the news that I will not name, but I think are an example of maybe not the greatest advocates.
Understood.
Right. Something GLAAD would tell me is that I cannot name that person.
In our circles, and we talked on the way to the studio that the way the industry for this type of podcast kind of works usually, and, you know, how it's a little bit like pro wrestling, I've incurred the wrath of certain individuals who are up here, we shall say,
sure,
for speaking out against, or I should say speaking for transparency and for, you know, ethics and broadcasting. And I can understand that, you know, you have to kind of pick your battles, as it were.
Right. I think that's that, you know, so I, yeah, I had to go through this course of, like, I had to watch all this stuff, and I would, you know, he would test me, and you just, I think there's a difference between, like, being a, like, I'm speaking at Yale in a few months, and I was talking to this group that I'm going to work with, and I was like, you know, I think one of the interesting topics to bring up would be, what is the difference between being, like, a private LGBTQ citizen who has, you know, his or her own beliefs and thoughts versus someone who has a platform and has to represent people who are very different from yourself. And sometimes that's a line that I have to walk all the time. And that's a line that GLAAD helps remind me. Like, sometimes I'll be like, oh, I want to write this, or I want to say this. And they'll be like, no, don't do it. Don't. Just don't. It's not like, you could say it, but, like, a lot of people are going to hate you for saying it. And it's like, is it really that important to you? So I fly the flag for GLAAD quite a bit. And through GLAAD, I've also gotten involved with this group called Transforming Families in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And they work with the parents and siblings and trans kids themselves, or kids themselves who are trans and are transitioning in elementary school, middle school, high school, college, or college age kids. And I mentor a group of trans boys in high school and college. So which is, it's very, very interesting work. It's I don't know. It's so weird dealing with high school students.
It's like you and I are, I think I'm actually a little bit older than you, but you and I are.
How old are you?
I'm 34. I just stopped there for a second. you're 32 now?
29.
Wow, I thought you were 32.
Everybody thinks I'm 32. You're like the ninth person to call me 32 in the past 2 weeks.
Again,
I went and bought out anti-wrinkle cream.
God damn it. No, it's not the age. Like, it's Wikipedia. Like, oh, like, Zeke is like in his 30s. I'm like, oh, this is great information. I should have, when I was emailing him, like, I should just ask, like, you know, give me your idea as far as, like, how old are you? Give me some basic.
Give me your idea as to how old you are. What is your idea?
Not
how old are you? What is your idea to ask your age might be?
If you ask my wife, I identify as a 20-year-old sometimes.
Fair enough.
So I'm, you know, there's there are certain levels of immaturity that I will go to. But kind of speaking of immaturity when it comes to high school, because I was very immature in high school. You do a lot of talks in colleges, college campuses. Like you mentioned, you're talking at my alma mater, Algonquin College.
Yes, in a few hours.
Best college ever.
Go Thunder.
Go Thunder. You're speaking at Yale. When did you start this campus tour?
Oh, actually, this is my this would be the start. Algonquin is my first, and I've spoken. Like, you know, people just reach out. Like I spoke at a high school class in Harlem in the spring before school let out, and then people started getting in touch, and I started doing podcasts. I've presented at a handful of, like, award shows and galas in Los Angeles. Yes. I presented the GLAAD Awards, which was so much fun. I've got Yale lined up. I've got Stanford lined up. Mm-hmm. I'm part of this film festival in New York in October. I'm speaking at Raytheon, which is a defense contractor. They make weapons, but they hire a lot of LGBTQ veterans.
Yes.
And have, like, a big, like, diversity affinity group. And I think particularly in the wake of the transgender military ban, like, want to, you know, reach out and affirm all of the trans veterans who work for Raytheon. So I'm going to speak at Raytheon.
Now,
well,
this is one thing I didn't, like I said, it's probably best to be able to ask what you don't or can't talk about. But I'm not sure if you're, like, willing to go into politics at all, just briefly, or touch on it, or if you can.
Sure. Okay. I mean, I can, there are some, like, secret things regarding Survivor that I can't talk about.
Okay,
but
well,
besides
and besides NDAs, like, I understand about non-disclosure agreements, trust me, I've had my fair share.
Right, for all the space porn.
For all the space porn, yes.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, man.
I mean, you've worked with some stars, right?
Well, man, you know, I have to say this much: it's like shooting porn in zero G is very difficult. There are some harnesses that are top secret that we cannot release or talk about.
I understand. And patent pending.
Now, speaking, well, man, I'm patent pending. You know, we're setting up the WordPress store and on, you know, on also a Shopify. We're gonna have a Shopify.
Oh, a Shopify.
A Shopify.
That's some serious shit there.
That is some serious shit right there.
Damn. I'll drink to that.
Now, one thing that it's not going to be on Shopify is orange tan spray. And we up in here in Canada, we've got a very progressive prime minister. And prime minister is kind of like the equivalent of a president down in the States.
I'm familiar. I know about PM Trudeau.
And he's a pretty hip and happening guy.
You sort of have the opposite leadership-wise of what we have right now.
Well, here's the thing. Like, from an economic, but like from a progressive standpoint, I can understand where he's coming from. From an economic policy standpoint, it's a little bit different. Like, we get like really deep and start, you know, hashing out very minute details when it comes to policy. When it comes to American politics, I've noticed that it's very, very, you know, very divisive. It's very, you've got your left, you've got your right, and there's, you know, in between seems to be everyone else.
Neither political party seems to represent what the majority of Americans believe.
They just want to live a normal life and get on with getting on.
Right, but so few Americans vote. So, like, the Americans who vote are the Americans who are on one side of the spectrum or the other. So it's all about like being able to fire up your base and then maybe having a message which appeals to just a scotch more of the people in the middle who are going to vote. But less than half the population votes because most of the population doesn't think that there's any room for them in politics.
Now, one of the big issues that was coming out of the States in the last, I'm going to say month, was the, you know, was the transgender ban in the military.
That's right.
And like, we're a post-postmodernist show where we're just like, we don't, it's like, hey man, like, what the hell are you doing down there? Like, that is insane when it comes to the president being able to say that.
Yeah.
It's
disheartening. I think the thing that,
it's stressful.
Yeah, because I also think part of the there was no problem. Like, it's like, there are about 15,000 trans service members, that's an estimated number, it's not confirmed, who serve without incident, and in most cases serve with distinction, and many, I think, policies that are against trans people, they're just done to be antagonistic towards the trans community. There's not an issue, right? Like, we have all these bathroom bills as well in cities and states throughout the United States, but there's never been I think there's been one or two documented incidents of a person using the bathroom corresponding with their gender identity. Like, there's been one or two incidents, like, throughout all times, all states in American history where there's been a problem, but there have been thousands and thousands of incidents of cisgender people committing acts of violence against trans people in bathrooms. But there is this culture of fear that they're able to stoke in certain people, and it becomes politically popular to target the LGBT community.
And it's because it fires up the base. Like, I have conservative friends, I have liberal friends. I'm kind of the guy in the middle where it's just like, I just love people. Like, are you an asshole? Are you a funny asshole? Then maybe we're not, you know, okay, then you're okay. If you're a mean asshole, then we're not going to talk. If you're, you know, like that, that's kind of my level of...
No, I'm with you. I'm like, there are two types of people. There are like assholes, and there are the people who try their best not to be assholes all the time.
Exactly.
Right? I'm not even saying that you don't have to, like, you can sometimes be an asshole. Just don't be an asshole all the time.
Exactly. It's like, oh my God. It's like, why can't you just like be a good person and like not give a shit? But it's become a political issue. Gender politics is, it's divisive even in itself. And it shouldn't have to be, because it's like, are you a good person? Are you somebody who cares for people? Do you help the community? Do you not do damage to the community?
Right.
Then it shouldn't matter what you are.
Yeah.
It shouldn't. And the fact that this is being brought out on a national level in the military, I've got friends who are transitioning. I've got friends in the military who are veterans. And I hear the horror stories that are coming out from that side, where there are people who called crisis lines because it's like, the president said this on a tweet. And it's like, it's a tweet. It's not policy. That's just somebody who has a phone who has an opinion. I've got opinions all the time. Usually they deal with space chickens. Again, we'll get to that. I'll tell you about it on the way.
You know, I saw that video with you and the space chickens and the gangbang.
Oh,
tremendous.
Man.
It was really good work. I'm surprised you didn't win an award for that.
Well,
I thought you were robbed. I started a petition.
you know, it,
it just
you
didn't
know,
go anywhere.
I went to Las Vegas. I was expecting to be nominated at one point and maybe win an award the next year. It just didn't happen. It just didn't happen.
I'm sorry, man.
God damn.
You know, I thought Survivor should have been nominated for an Emmy. I think it's really the best reality show on television. Didn't get nominated. I was devastated. Those awards, they're just so political. They don't really reflect who's doing the good work, and you're the one who's doing the good work.
When you're, well, I gotta, okay, like, I'm sorry, I'm just getting a little bit flushed here. I'm just like, oh my God, see, he actually said something nice about the show here. Oh shit, okay. Now I'm losing my place. See, a good smile and a wink goes, exactly, there you go. I'm trying to see here, where the hell did I go?
Well, no, I get you. I think you're right. I think the majority of people don't care.
Majority of the people don't. And the ones who do, they're the ones who...
They just scream the loudest. See, this is why I hate Twitter. I know you're all about the multiple media platforms. But I think Twitter is so toxic because people just give it too much weight. But nobody on Twitter has any obligation to use Twitter responsibly. So there is this example. This is, you know, tangential, but I'm on Twitter, but I will rail against Twitter anytime. So there's this show on Broadway on this past season. Mm-hmm. One of the four shows who was nominated for, you know, Best New Musical, called The Comet of, I think, 1812. Mm-hmm. Initially it starred Josh Groban. Mm-hmm. Great show. To replace Josh Groban, they brought in, I forget his name, an actor who... from Hamilton, from the original cast of Hamilton. And it was noted because they were replacing a white actor with a black actor, which is uncommon, but not unheard of by any means. But the show went from having like a huge name like Josh Groban, who, you know, the people from Iowa would know, I know Josh Groban, I want to go buy a ticket to see Josh Groban, to a name that was really only appreciated within the Broadway community. Like, it went from a big name to a small name, and ticket sales
plummeted.
Took a hit.
Yeah.
And also, the actor wasn't happy in the role. So he didn't want to... He was signed up for 6 weeks and I think was leaving after four. And, like, the actor wasn't happy. The actor wasn't a good fit. He was having problems with the directors and the producers and everything. So they announced that they were bringing in Mandy Patinkin, who is a white actor and also a big name. He's a legendary Broadway actor. He was on Criminal Minds. He's a name that people know. And Twitter was in an uproar that because of ticket sales, they were replacing the black actor with a white actor. But that's not what happened. Like, the story was so much more nuanced, but it caused such a chaos. Like, there was so much controversy on Twitter that Mandy Patinkin pulled out. They were unable to find an actor to fill the role, and the show closed.
Oh my God.
And hundreds of people, hundreds of musicians and actors and artists and stagehands lost their job because there was an uproar on Twitter about a thing that a lot of people didn't know about.
And this is what I've noticed is when it comes to art, and I'm speaking as a millennial here. You and I are kind of at the cusp of what millennials actually can be considered. I think I'm like, it's supposed to be like around 1984, I'm 83, so I could be like Gen Y, I don't even know.
I think if you were on Survivor, you would have been on the Gen X tribe.
Oh, son of a bitch.
I know.
Like, are you kidding me?
I would have loved to be on the Gen X tribe.
Oh, man. The music. Well, I'm sorry. To anyone out there in like our younger demographic, the music was better when I was growing up. I'm sorry. Except for like the 80s. That was just, we don't talk about the 80s. We don't.
They didn't happen.
Except for Flock of Seagulls. That was just, come on. Oh, and New Kids on the Block. That was fantastic.
Sure.
I'm trying to think. Just as like a side note, this is kind of funny. I'm going to get a little bit real here. When I was growing up, my sister's 6 years older than I am, and I actually had a New Kids on the Block, like pretend group with my like 6-year-old friends, and we actually used to sing "Hanging Tough." That's how cool New Kids on the Block was in the 80s. So we can go there. Now, with anybody of an age that would be college age or more, what would be like a, you know, if you're going on this advocacy tour, have you had any major experiences that like you have had like great joy and say like, I'm making a difference so far?
Yeah, I have a lot of those. They're typically not in big broad, like they're not at the GLAAD Awards. The GLAAD Awards is a big party, mm-hmm. right? But I mean, yeah, I guess I didn't appreciate how common the experience of being outed is. It had never happened to me before. But so I got contacted by a mom of a little trans boy in Brooklyn. He's 12 years old. And it's so crazy now that kids transition when they're like wee bitty. They don't even transition. They just announce their gender identity and their parents are like, okay, we should look into this. And then they just get to like live, which is awesome. And he, you know, parents, they figured out what was going on early and got his stuff in order. And he went to a new middle school where nobody knew. And he was great. He was just being himself, going to school, having a good time, doing his thing, being like any other kid. And then somehow a girl found out and announced it to the entire school about a week after my episode of Survivor aired, the big episode. And this mom was able to convince her kid to go back to school and to be brave and face his peers through using my experience on Survivor. Like, what I did was able to be an example for him. And the more and more trans kids I meet, they have a similar experience. They'll be at a new school, or they'll go from middle school to high school, and people won't know, and they'll just be doing their thing, being regular kids, and then some. And I have provided them the model of how to respond. I've given them permission to be strong and to move on. And I think that's the stuff that matters. You know, that you've given a kid in a hard situation an alternative that's not depression or suicide, but strength. Because when I came home from Survivor and I knew I had 9 months to prepare for like this moment, prepare for this role that I would occupy, I Googled like, you know, trans outing or trans public outing, and all of the results were suicide, right? Like, it was just like this woman had killed herself and this person had killed themselves. And it was just, one of my things that drove me was like, there needs to be another search result. There needs to be an alternative that's not your life is over, but it's like, yeah, so like this happened. Okay, not great. So go on and kick ass. Don't, you know, let it, find a way to make, you know, the challenges, you know, let a challenge be an opportunity to build new muscles that you can use going forward. And those are the moments that really, I think, resonate most with me.
Oh man, I'm sorry. Okay, give me a second. I'm good. From your greatest joy, what's been the biggest challenge? Even from the experiences of advocacy to your own being outed and having to face that within, as you mentioned, 9 months. What's been the biggest challenge for you so far?
The biggest challenge? Gosh, well, I think it's that thing of having this platform and figuring out what you want to say, or what I wanted to say, or what mattered to me. I would say about 30 people in my life knew that I was trans. It was not a widely known fact about me. My feeling was like, because when I first transitioned in college, it was about 10 years ago, and it was so foreign that no one had a good response. Like, nobody wanted to, like, get, they just stayed away. You know, there were the conservative people who were like, oh, we don't know what this is, but it seems gay, and we don't like it. And then there were the liberal people who were like, well, I don't know. It seems like you're buying into binary gender norms, and, like, shouldn't you just, like, try to be fluid, or, you know, isn't it, like, you know, buying into the patriarchy if you're going to be a man. Like, so there was liberal people who were kind of not on board, and then most people didn't know what to think. And so, you know, those early years of transitioning where I was visibly trans were really traumatic. And then, you know, I just, by the time I graduated and moved to New York and got a job, nobody knew. And it was so nice to just be me. And it was just sort of like, oh, hey, this is a great way to live, where people respect me. So I typically only would tell people I was trans after I knew them for a while. Mm-hmm. And so all of which is to say, it's not like being trans is something I talked about a lot before. So I had to learn, I had to figure out what it was I wanted to say. And I think I thought back to what is the advice I would have given a younger version of myself? What are some of the mistakes that I've made? How have I held myself back because I was trans? What are things that I would now do differently knowing what I know now? And that's where I found my message, which is about, you know, go after what you want. Yeah, there's going to be risks. Bad things could happen. So just prepare for them. Prepare for the challenges ahead. But don't let that be a reason why you don't do what you want in life.
Now, I'm going to ask one more. I'm going to take a Lisa's statement from the YouTube channel, because we are kind of an interactive show.
Totally.
And then after that, I'm going to okay, let's see here. So Craig says, I blame the 80s on cocaine.
Well, that's fair.
That's fair, yeah.
Cocaine, not my favorite drug.
Now, this is from a gentleman I'm going to call Tony. The 80s is better than what it is now. Okay, that's a little bit different.
I would say you're not wrong.
Now, there's one question that's saying, kids being trans is sketchy, not saying it's bad, just seems too young. There's a couple more lines here, because even for myself, I don't type an entire thought out in one line. I'll agree with that, but identity is being PC. It just seems like a trend, though. Well, how would you respond to that?
Well, I would say that the identity being PC, I understand where you're coming from. As far as kids being trans, I think the thing with gender identity, and it's true for me and it's true for a lot of kids, is that you, before you're inculcated into this world of like LGBTQ, and a lot of kids, like I did, had a very strong understanding of themselves as like either a boy or a girl. It's like, oh, I'm a boy. I was like, oh yeah, I'm a boy. I've got a brother. I'm like him. Like, that's, we're the same. And you just sort of know, and it's not a political thing, just from a very young age, you know. And it used to be that kids like me tried to fix us and, you know, say, no, you're wrong. And that just always led to bad results. It's a terrible thing to be told that you have an understanding of yourself and that your internal understanding of yourself is wrong. So what happens with trans kids is, you know, they see therapists, they see doctors, and no one does anything that can't be undone until kids are a little bit older. But what they can do is provide kids with puberty blockers, which prevent the development of unwanted secondary sex characteristics. So it doesn't stop that from ever happening. It just delays it until you can take cross-gender hormones, or if it turns out you're not trans, you can allow the course of things. So all it does is leave your options open. It doesn't, you know, permanently say one thing or another, but there are many trans clinics targeted towards young people across the United States, and I would assume in Canada as well, because Canada tends to be a little bit ahead of the curve as far as like progressive healthcare goes.
I would hope so. Like, I haven't actually looked into it myself, but you know, it's very well possible. Like, it's a much different medical system up here.
Sure.
So, but trying to get into the mind of somebody for, you know, who's gone through that process and who has realized at a younger, you know, younger age that they're, okay, well, this is not the body that I'm supposed to be in. What is the mind frame that somebody, you know, would recognize that? Like, what is the thought process? How does one go through that?
As a kid or as an adult?
Well, is it a kid or an adult?
I think as a kid, most kids just are like, oh, this is like you. You're just like, oh, I know that I'm a boy. For me, it was about the same. I just had this basic understanding of myself. People just told me something else was true. And I believed them because I was a kid and they seemed to be pretty passionate about that. Even though, you know, you have your understanding of yourself and you have what people are telling you, but you always feel the incongruity. Mm. And for me, I didn't know what it was. So I, throughout my life, I started putting different names to it. Mm-hmm. And because I didn't know that trans people existed, really. I especially didn't know trans men didn't exist until I got to college. So for me, I was always looking for what is my out? Like, how do I not have to be a girl? Because this seems to be like the worst fucking thing in the world. And for me, first it was like there were lesbians. And I was like, there are cargo shorts and short hair and baseball jerseys involved in that. So that seems to be right. And it wasn't about like being attracted to women. It was like, this seems to be my out of long hair and makeup and dresses. And that, so that's what I am. And I was like, this is what I am. This is what the deal is with me. This is why I don't have to participate in girlhood as everyone else seems to be participating in it. But I grew up in Oklahoma City, which is very conservative. And there were not a lot of out LGBT people in, this would be the Bush era. Bush era. And it's funny for me every time. It's funny. It's always funny. So I got to college in very liberal Massachusetts, in Boston, which had like just legalized gay marriage. They were the first state to do so. And I was like, great, I'm going to go hang out with other like gay people. I will have finally found my crew. The years of isolation are over. And I was just doing my thing. And almost immediately when I got to college, they were like, have you heard of this thing called trans? Because we think you're trans. Like, you don't seem to be like all the other like gay women. You seem to have something else going on with you. And I was like, fuck you. I didn't like that because I didn't have friends growing up. And I thought, finally, I'm going to go to college. And I'm going to get to fit in. And the message, like, you know, what I was understanding is that I was something even more different, that was even smaller and weirder at the time. I mean, now there's, I think, more broad acceptance. But at the time, it was super weird. And I was like, I don't want to be this thing which is going to further isolate me. But the more and more I reflected on it, and the more I'd been given permission to understand myself as a man, I was like, yeah, no, this is the thing. Like, this is the deal. It's not that I want to sleep with women. It's that, like, I'm a guy.
Now, conservatives will especially in places like Russia, they shut down any talk of this whatsoever.
Sure.
In the United States, it's a lot more open. It's become kind of the forefront, as we talked about before, with identity politics. I'm a firm believer that the necessity to be able to talk openly and be able to say, okay, well, this isn't pushing an agenda. This is be able to say, this is happening. It can be very difficult and very hard for people to understand or go through. And that open discussion needs to be able to happen to ensure that the right information is getting out and that people are getting the help or the advice that they need to figure things out instead of, you know, just getting offhand or third hand advice. It's like, if I am going to, I'm going to bring the, and I know this is a very bad analogy, so please don't think that I'm diminishing this. When I built this studio, my wife said one thing: talk to the experts. Don't just do it yourself. And what I do, I went to Home Depot. I talked to her father, who is a handyman. And I said, how is it I do these things so that I don't fuck it up?
Sure.
So that I know the right path that I'm on.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there would have been a lot more bones broken. You know, the house would have fallen down. And metaphorically speaking, that could happen to a lot of people out there. So this type of discussion needs to happen. I'm a firm believer that if you want other people to have that different search result, that it needs to be open, it needs to be discussed, and we can't be held back by the prejudices of, you know, what politicians say. I believe it has to be something that generally is an ideal that we have to help people. We have to help people live their lives. We have to help them live properly and live happy lives. So, you know, the advocacy that you've been doing has just been phenomenal. Like that's one of the big things that has always been coming up for any search result that I do. My research has always been, well, Zeke's talking here. This is, you know, here's a photo of him shaking hands with somebody else. And it's a role model position. How have you been taking that as a mantle? Like, is it a heavy weight to bear? Is it something that you've been okay with?
I mean, not to use a pun, but it's definitely been a transition. I mean, before, because here's the thing is, like, yes, I have this position and I take it very seriously. Mm-hmm. But I'm also a guy with a dumb mustache, a stupid shirt collection, and a desire to be on reality television. So it's not like I'm the most upstanding citizen in the world.
No, let me correct you there. Your mustache is nowhere close to as dumb as mine, because mine is spectacularly dumb.
I think you need to stop trimming it, and then you can color it in with, like, Just for Men.
See, everyone keeps telling me that, and I'm just like, no. I'm just going to, like, you know, get the blonde hairs with the black, and then I'll, you know, kind of...
you know. Oh, I definitely color my mustache.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
For full effect.
You and I are going to talk afterwards on mustache. Because I've had, and one of my good friends, Scotty Roberts, he's a conservative, has one of the most magnificent mustaches on the planet. We had him on this show, one of our first shows back in January of last year. Talked mustache lore. I was getting slammed in the chat room. We want to hear about the Anunnaki. Fuck the mustaches. I'm like, I need some actual advice here. So we will discuss that. Hopefully, we have some time at the end of the show. If not, we'll on the ride back to Algonquin.
Great.
Let's shift gears into a little bit more levity.
Great.
Okay. Your shirt style is one of the most awesome I've ever seen. I wish I could wear that. Like, I've got plain white. It's okay, I guess. How did you get onto the a cockatiel blue on pink? Because that is awesome.
Thank you. I don't know. Like about 4 years ago, I bought the shirt actually that I wore on Millennials versus Gen X, which if you, at least at the beginning, towards the end, it's so dark that you can't even tell, which is it's got all these big colors and patterns and, you know, I bought it sort of as a joke, and I put it on, and I was like, oh, you look good in this. And then I bought another one, and I was like, oh, you look good in this. And it was, I would wear them out, and people would be like, hey, your shirt's good, and you look good in the shirt. So for me, my shirt style, this is literally what I look best in. Like, it complements me for whatever reason, more so than, like, plain clothes. But there was a bit of a mental block of, like, are you really going to go out of the house in this? But when it just started to pay dividends, I was like, fuck it, it's my thing.
Okay.
I definitely have purchased more, though, since it sort of became my signature look.
Now, I'm going to be blunt. I'm a graphic designer. I know color. Uh-huh. It makes your eyes pop very much.
Oh, like thank you.
The hair color with, like, the blonde, with the sun-swept Californian tan, it works very well. Yeah. I would make an image or some type of wallpaper, possibly. You know, carpet design.
I that was one of my, when I thought, so I'm a big believer in goal setting, just giving yourself a very, very hyper-specific direction. And one of the things I hoped, this is before I went, I hoped would potentially come out of Survivor, is that maybe someone would contact me about partnering on a shirt line of, like, goofy pattern shirts.
Oh my God, we actually have a line of clothing that I'm hoping to expand. So if you ever want to do that, I'm totally.
I would love to. But I get most, like, this shirt, both the shirts I wore on Survivor and most of the shirts you'll see me in are from this men's online clothing retailer called Bonobos.
I've heard of them.
Yes, named after the primate that is, I think, the only known species aside from humans that masturbates. Or has procreative sex as well.
Dolphins.
Dolphins masturbate?
Dolphins will...
That seems... I mean, not to like... I don't... Not to knock dolphins, but they don't seem like they have the capacity to do so.
Well, that's why they're known to be... Well, okay, here's the thing.
Because I know dolphins are known to kind of be a little rapey.
Yeah, no. There have been, like, reports of... wow, this took a weird turn for podcast. let's see. There have been reports of like test dummies that have been dragged down to depths and, like, they're located, you know, inland somewhere, but it's actually like in a cave where, like, pools of or pods of dolphins have, like, taken this mannequin and raped it to death. Well, death.
Well, you know, right.
Into pieces. Dolphins are weird, man. They're assholes. Like, okay, killer whales are cool. Dolphins, they can be a little dangerous, but they're okay in, like, small numbers, but they'll still do weird things against your leg. Just putting that out there.
I'm gonna stay away from dolphins then.
Okay, now this is coming in from Antonio. Do you deal a lot with machismo? And I think this is related to the mustache.
Oh,
because it is epic.
Thank you. Machismo, why? In the sense of, like, my own relationship to masculinity?
Sure.
Yeah, all the time. I mean, yeah, I think, like most guys, I have insecurities about my masculinity and want to compensate in various ways and, you know, do so by being, you know, aggressive or, I don't know, bro-y or what have you, for sure.
Well, there you go. Well, you know, just be able to say, I can understand that your arms are bigger than, like, you've got, like, good, yeah, you got some good, some definition there.
Yeah, I do CrossFit. I love to lift.
There you go.
I actually, Survivor got me into lifting. I was not a lifter, And then when I was like, I'm going to apply for Survivor, I was like, if you're going to do this, you've got to like commit to going to the gym like 4 days a week. And I ended up like paying for a big gym membership, which include personal training sessions. And I'd never like pumped iron, like deadlift and cleaned and all that stuff. And that's what personal training like taught me how to do. And now I love it. I love lifting. I'm not like the most graceful or coordinated person, but like movements related to barbells just seem to make sense with my body.
What's your routine like?
Well, I'm a CrossFit guy, so I go 3 to 4 times a week, and you do whatever the workout of the day is, the WOD.
Okay, I'm gonna say I have not been to the gym for a while.
Okay.
But like I'll just do weights. Like, you know, I've got my usual routine. I'll go like do my 2-3 sets, high weights one day, low weights the other day, and it, you know, it works for me just because like for me the repetitiveness will allow me to be able to work through certain problems creatively or just, you know, in day to day life. That I think like CrossFit requires a little bit too much thinking, whereas just with lifting, you're just like,
well, I think for me, it's actually the opposite, because sometimes I miss it though. Sometimes I miss just going open gym and doing, if it's open gym, I'll typically do I'll be on a 5x5 program.
Okay.
Which is you lift 3 days a week and there are like 3 different movements. You do like 5 sets of 5, regardless. There's a great app called Strong Lifts if you're interested in doing 5x5. But for me, I'm in my head dealing with like problems all of the time. Like my internal monologue just does not shut up. And there are only 2 things which will, well, there's one thing which shuts it up and then one thing which just like redirects it. So the thing that shuts it up is going to a difficult workout class where someone else tells me what to do. And that the physical activity and the desire to push myself just overrides my internal monologue, which only happens in classes. It only happens when I have the peer pressure of other people working out around me and the direction of someone telling me specifically what I have to do, when I have to do it, and holding me accountable for it. It's a switch which overrides my brain, which sometimes is what I need to get out of like thinking ruts. Because I think sometimes when I'm dealing with a difficult problem creatively, it's because my mind is just caught in a loop, right? Like the spinny wheel of death, like on your Apple. And I need something to like get me to think about something else, right? Or get me a new way of viewing, a new entry point into viewing a problem.
How did this help? Like, did you do CrossFit before you went on Survivor? I'm going to switch things around here just because I want to be able to get that out of the way.
Sure. The gym I went to in Brooklyn was not technically CrossFit.
Okay.
But everyone there was a certified CrossFit coach, and we did like, when I went to a CrossFit gym, I had to like go through all of these like initial things. I knew how to do all the stuff because we did all the same movements. It just wasn't like on brand CrossFit. So yes, for I would say 9 months, I became a gym rat. I mean, I was at the gym twice a day for the better part of 9 months. It was great. I had so much fun.
Oh, okay.
I wish I could work up that, like, because I knew I was going to be on national television in my underwear, so I wanted to look the best I could. So that's what got me out of bed every morning at 6 a.m. to go to the gym and back at 6 p.m. Nothing else in my life has motivated me to be that good of a gym rat since.
I'm going to be blunt. Like, I'm a very self-conscious guy. Every single time I'm on this camera, I always think about, okay, well, do I look like shit? Do I look like, you know, like, after 6 months, I've had people, they'll comment like, why the hell do you wear the, you know, why are you wearing that hat? Like, the hat is apparently a part of me now. This is like my signature hat.
Sure. Yeah.
And I don't notice it. And I don't notice it. But the one thing that I always have to be able to apologize for is if it's really, really hot. And thankfully, we're now in this lovely new studio that has air conditioning.
Yeah, very chill.
Where I'm not sweating constantly. And that was the major thing that I'm self-conscious for.
Is your sweat?
No, because I'm like, I'm glistening. And it just looks really bad on camera. I've got like the fans going. Just all you hear is just behind.
You just need a sweat rag. Yeah, just wipe off.
That was, yeah, no, I actually had one of those at one point. It's like, oh, just like dab, 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 dab. And it's like when you're on Survivor, like I know you're on. And I'm just switching around the segments here because I want to finish off the creative the creative side.
Sure.
How hot is it out there? Like, you're in Fiji, right?
Yeah, we're in Fiji both times. We were actually there in Fiji in winter. So there were a couple, right? But there are a couple. Look, if you are living on a desert island where you're spending your time in your swim trunks, like where you've got swim trunks or wet pants, you want it to be hot. You don't want it to be that cool. And what cool means is, gosh, below 75, you're pretty chilly. There were a couple of days in Millennials Gen X in which we were, I guess maybe that was more fall, where we had hot days, but for the most part, it wasn't that hot. Also, you spend very little time out sort of in the sun. You're mostly, all of our camps were built back into the jungle. So you're under the canopy most days. But no, I would say if I had a temperature issue on Survivor, it was that it was 60 degrees at night. And if you don't have a blanket, that's cold.
Really? That's it? That's like, we get down to about like 65 here. And like that, for us, that's been relief.
Sure.
We've been like in a heat wave, as you probably may have noticed. Like,
yeah, people keep saying it's a heat wave. It feels about the same temperature that it feels back where I live. So I understand why that's different. For me, it's not hot.
You also have to understand is that it gets to... I'm going to do some quick calculations here because I'm very bad with... I've learned temperatures above 0 Celsius, but let's just see here. So Celsius to Fahrenheit.
I can understand. So in Ottawa, you have seasons. That's an East Coast thing. When I was in New York, there were seasons. When I was in Boston, there were seasons. Oh. Oklahoma, they're not really seasons. LA has the same weather within like a 10-degree flexibility.
We have the largest of any capital city, I think, except for like the capital of Mongolia. We've got the largest temperature swing of any city on the planet. And it goes from plus 45 Celsius, which is... 113 to 120.
Damn.
To minus 40 Fahrenheit in the winter.
Jeez.
So, this is September. Like, it is fall now. And it was 30 degrees. It's going to be 30 degrees this... I'm trying to see here. 86. It's going to be 86 this weekend. 90 with humidity, because it's a very humid part of the country. It should be... 59 right now, give or take. That's a rough estimate.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I think if the planet is telling us anything right now between the earthquakes and the hurricanes and the temperature swings, it's that it is not happy.
Mother Nature is a bitch, and yeah. She is not happy right now. If you were going to say one thing to anybody who is on Survivor, or I should say, who wants to go on Survivor in terms of temperature, what would be a way that they could actually prepare for that?
Well, what I did was, because I went on Survivor after like 3 months of East Coast winter, which New York winter is not as bad as an Ottawa winter, but it's, you know, I think I walk to the gym most days in 17 degrees, which I'm not sure what that translates to Celsius, but that's well below freezing.
How many degrees?
17. So 17 degrees Fahrenheit, which 32 is freezing.
Minus 8.5, give or take.
All right, cool. Well, you know, it's pretty chilly. But yeah, like, I went to winter, so what I would do every time I worked out is I would sit in a 150-degree sauna to start acclimating my body to the heat.
Mm.
And so if you're coming from winter, spend some time in the sauna. What I would do in the sauna is I would read books on, like, you know, social strategy and making friends and, like, mental toughness techniques. I read this great book called, like, How Bad Do You Want It, which was targeted towards people who run, like, ultra marathons.
Nice.
And it actually was helpful as, like, a way to rewire the way that your brain processes pain.
And, like, there are probably some podcasts out there, and I think there's the Age of Persuasion would be one. I think that's what it was actually called. I forget. Like, there are certain podcasts I'll listen to as far as, like, being able to talk to people, get to know people better. Because I'm a very, not really antisocial, but I'm a very shy individual.
Sure.
I hate meeting new people because I'm always afraid that I'm going to fuck up or they're not going to like me or what have you. And there's always that fear that it's like, oh, my goodness, how do I actually get, you know, to change the way that I do things? And I've started listening to all these podcasts to try and get better at it and get better at social discourse. And it's interesting to be able to see that it's very similar when somebody's actually trying to get onto a show or knowing that they're going on that type of show.
Yeah.
Because
for me,
helps.
I'm the same way. And the thing that I did is I read this Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. And I recommend it to everybody because the whole argument of that book is be the person that you want to interact with. Like, be excited to see somebody, be interested in what they have to say. Like, if you're nervous, people will be nervous because they think that you don't like them. So it's all about mirroring to the other person what you want them to mirror back to you. But yeah, no, I'm the same way. I had to study how to be a better social interactor because I carry a lot of social anxiety myself.
Now, how did friendships, because again, like you've probably been asked a million questions about like, what's the strategy like in Survivor? Like, don't be an asshole. It's pretty hard. Only be an asshole at the right amount of time. Friendships are important, that I've noticed from Survivor, is that they tend to stay after the show's done. You spend about a month or two in very close proximity with some with a lot of these people.
Yeah.
Now, one friendship you have that I've been getting a lot of very heartwarming smiles from is yours with Hannah.
Yep.
Now, can you give me an idea of how that, well, besides the show, how has that continued after the show?
Sure. Well, I think the origin story of Hannah, or as we are better known, Heek, which is Hannah and Zeke.
I thought it was Heke. No, this is good. Canadian pronunciation.
No, it's meant to be. It's a gruff, hard pronounce. Heek, not okay. Xana. We went for Heek over Xana. So I do. My background is in comedy.
Yes.
So I participate, or I used to participate in this improv and sketch comedy theater called the Upright Citizens Brigade in New York. They also have, which is, I mean, it's essentially a religion. It's basically a cult. I mean, we could get into, I mean, that could be its own whole podcast, but let's just leave it at that. Hannah participates in the Upright Citizens Brigade in Los Angeles. So we get put on an island together, and I'm like, who's the nerd? Nerd girl. You, me. Nerd girl, let's go be friends. Because I'm like, this is going to be a natural pairing. I ask her about her life, and she tells me she's UCB LA. I'm UCB New York. We're both part of the same cult. It's like being out there with a fellow Scientologist. So we're like, of course we're going to connect, right? We're comedians, we're weird. Hannah would betray me time and time again. We had this, like, I think that's the thing is, if you watched Millennials Gen X, you saw Hannah and I go to war with each other a couple of different times. But what you didn't see was, like, we would just be, like, the best of friends, and then Hannah would betray me. We'd be the best of friends, and then Hannah would betray me.
I know. It's just, like, it was so maddening. I'm like, why can't you just work together, damn it?
I have to ask her. But yeah, so I would say Hannah is the only person after the show that I actually had to have like a bit of a real reconciliation, because the time we were friends, it felt so real. And then when she would betray me, it hurt more than when other people would betray me. Cause I was like, but we seem to have this connection that's deeper. So we kind of had it out, and then we just became super close. And, we have, so I'm gay, and that was part of, you know, being, that was on the show. I was, it's sort of like the epic moment of the season is like me and this guy Brett comes out to me, and we have this like big moment. So it's not like it's a very well-known fact that I'm gay. And we started doing, just, it became fun. It was after the finale of Millennials versus Gen X. The entire cast went to Vegas, and we started taking all of these like romantic pictures together as if we were some sort of like showmance. It culminated in us getting engaged, and we just had picture after picture. And what was so much fun about it is that we'd spent the past like 4 months with these idiots on Twitter and Instagram and all over the internet saying mean things about you and judging this thing you said or that thing you did. And sometimes when you're new to being inundated with social media, you take all that stuff really personally, right? Like if someone says something mean about you, it hurts. And you don't necessarily have the perspective that this is some sort of idiot middle schooler in their, like, you know, using their mom's laptop or, right? You just, you take it seriously. But what doing Heek, which was just so clearly a joke, it was so clearly not real. Like, initially, like, 80% of people believed it was true.
It's like,
yeah. It's like, oh, are Zeke and Hannah together? It's like, what the hell are you talking about? And everything else that we would do, every time, like, it became this game because, like, so many people believed it was real, and they were into it. They were, like, committed to us as a couple. People were really confused. And then there was, like, a segment of the population that really understood that it was a joke and found it funny. And what it helped us do was both was detach from what people said about us on the internet and be like, oh, at least 50% of the people who are talking to you at any time are complete idiots because they believe that we're engaged.
Okay, this is something that you and I can relate on. We mentioned that I'll mention it again, that this kind of podcast can be kind of like pro wrestling. So the reason I mention this is because there is, I'm going to switch into like UFO tinfoil hat on here.
Great.
There is a guy out there named, I'm not going to name him. You know who you are.
You know who you are, asshole.
Kind of, yeah. No, there's a couple episodes I've called him out completely. So he's claiming to be a time-traveling space marine. Talks with blue bird aliens, and that he's disclosing this knowledge to humankind. I'm not shitting you.
So wait, if he's a space marine... So marines are, I mean, at their core, they are infantry soldiers who can go from sea to land. Is that still what his specialty is in space?
Well, no, he was on Mars. That's the thing. He was a Marine on Mars. Oh, by the way, he also served with Barack Obama, who is also a space Marine.
Interesting.
Now, the reason that this was kind of an issue, and I've called him out on the show a couple of times, and there's no way in hell he'll ever come on here just because I'll butcher him badly, is that he is getting paid hefty sums of money to do speaking engagements, to do this whole, we are, like... Here is the real disclosure of alien interaction with humans, and he's also kind of what's the best way to be able to put it? He's like passive aggressively like threatened people with death, like he's like I'm talking like really crazy shit, and we just
You can get paid massive sums of money to talk about aliens?
Oh, fuck yes, you can.
I'm in the wrong business.
Oh, dude.
Screw trans people. I need to start talking about aliens.
Well, here's the thing. I had a chance to be able to get to that level. I'm just like, no, I'm not going to fucking deal with that shit. Like, I'd rather be able to have fun with you.
Right, sure.
And which one's that?
I think it's the gray one.
The gray one? Okay.
Coco?
Yeah, the Coco. She's like, I'm here. I'm like, yes, I know. Okay, good. So that was kind of the idea, is that they're playing this thing. The thing is that they're doing it seriously, and it's this entire massive business, because it's advertising revenue, it's all this whole thing, and speaking engagements, and, you know, it's tens of dollars in comparison to real show business. And the thing is, they're doing it seriously, where you're doing it as a joke. And the people who are running that, you know, the larger shows... They were doing it from the standpoint of, well, people should know it's entertainment. I'm like, but you're not telling people it's entertainment. You're promoting it, you know, classically, and people will believe them. And it's like, people will shell out a lot of money for that. And it's like, dude, use some critical thinking and some rational thought here. And
well, I don't know. I mean, if we live in a capitalist society and there are idiots who... Right, want to consume that media, then why not provide it for them?
Well, that's kind of
right.
Also...
It's like there are a lot of great comedians who write for, you know, The Big Bang Theory or Two Broke Girls. I don't know if you get either of those sitcoms here, but
yes, we do.
Right, they're terrible sitcoms. Right, they're terrible television shows, but it's a way to make money. To advance yourself, right? Even though you don't believe in the show or the comedy.
Well, and that is one aspect of looking at it, and
Right? It's like the people, like the big wig executives who run McDonald's, they don't eat McDonald's. They would never put that poison in their bodies. But they don't mind making money on the people who will eat McDonald's.
God damn it. Now you're making me feel all just like, oh, man, maybe I should have gone that route. Okay.
Well, I think it's all about your values, right? I mean, I would never work for McDonald's.
True.
I can't say that I wouldn't write for The Big Bang Theory. If they offered me a job, I'd probably take it. But, you know...
If anybody works for The Big Bang Theory, you know, give Zeke a writing job. Now, this is one thing...
Yeah, Chuck Lorre. Chuck Lorre listens to your podcast, right?
2 Chainz listened to this podcast. I'm not sure if he knows Chuck Lorre, but...
Oh, well, 2 Chainz, hook me up, brother.
All right, there you go. So 2 Chainz, if you're listening, talk to Chuck Lorre, and we'll get Zeke on that show for writing. Okay, so here's a good question, and we got about 25 minutes left. Smokers on Survivor. This is one thing that I've always kind of theorized on, where it's like, I've quit. I've gone to the vape beforehand, sure, when I first started watching, and I should say that the first season that I watched was the one where Tony won.
Kagayan, that's a great season.
Oh my god. Okay, I have to say is that you are tied with Tony as my favorite Survivor contestant.
Oh, that means a lot, because Tony's my favorite Survivor contestant.
Because Tony was fucking awesome. He's like,
Tony's the best.
Didn't give a shit.
He's no, like, Tony's crazy.
I will swear to my mother and my brother and my son, and it's like this: I will not fuck you over next tribal council. I'll fuck them over. Just like, that's awesome.
No, Tony is. That's what I wanted to do because Tony's just so much fun. Like, oh, he doesn't care. He's just like. I could never, I couldn't, I mean, Tony's brilliant. I could never pull it off like he could, but yeah, no, Tony.
Oh, so if you ever talk to him, just say like, Tony, oh my God, just like, he is my fucking hero when yeah. it comes to that shit. Because he's like, I play the game, fuck you guys. If you don't like it, he's like, yeah, he makes a good case there. Give him,
yeah.
You know.
But Smoker's on Survivor.
Smoker's on Survivor.
I don't, actually, I don't know. God, look, it's not like, you don't, I mean, you get sunscreen, you get hand sanitizer, and you get bug spray. And then if you have, like, contacts, you'll get contacts and contact solution. If you have a prescription medication, there's some stuff they'll let you have out there. Like, if you have, like, women get birth control.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess maybe if you were prescribed something like Chantix, maybe they'd let you have that. But there's definitely no nicotine patches. You are, I mean... You're cut off. There's this guy. So in Survivor Panama, Exile Island, which I believe is season 11 or 12, there's this guy named Shane Powers who is, I mean, one of my favorite players. It's, oh God, the Shane story is, but Shane is like a hardcore chain smoker. I think he had like a two or three pack a day habit before he went out, and he just was not able to kind of like cut it. So Survivor was his cold turkey, and he like is actively in tobacco withdrawal and is losing it. Like, he finds a piece of wood and starts to like treat it as his BlackBerry, and he's emailing and texting people from the island, and like will like has to carry it with him and like, blows up at people. No, he's in full cold turkey active tobacco withdrawal on Survivor.
So that wouldn't help with like things like challenges, which you are quite good at from what I can recall.
I was always a solid challenge performer. I really excelled in puzzles.
Oh my God, yes, you, like, just like, oh, this is a puzzle like Zeke's winning. Like,
yeah.
Done. How did you get so good at that? Was this just something that is natural to you, or?
I've always been a good puzzler. I've always liked puzzles. But no, like, I'm a huge Survivor fan, so I would, you know, Survivor's very predictable, and I was like, well, I need to get better at balance, I need to get, like, whatever, but I should really spend a lot of time working on my puzzle ability, because they always put this nerdy smart guy on the puzzles. And I... Yeah, so I practiced all different sorts of puzzles before I went out, and here's the thing about Survivor puzzles. They're not that hard. They're about as difficult as a 60-piece, like, children's puzzle that you would get at Toys R Us. Though Toys R Us is going bankrupt, so not Toys R Us
anymore. Here in Canada, too, possibly.
Yeah, I'm sure all over the world. I mean, Amazon is everywhere. Why would you go to Toys R Us? But yeah, so 90%, but so they're not that hard, but they're all about staying calm. So I just, once I figured that out, that the biggest piece of the puzzle, hey, was staying calm, I just got good at staying calm. I think I also became confident that no one was going to beat me on a puzzle after a certain point. So I was like, I'm in my wheelhouse. This is the easiest thing I'm going to do all day is go and kill it on the puzzle.
I'm not sure if this, but this has probably been asked of you before a million times, so you probably know the answer to this. In terms of the challenges, obviously the need to eat is there. And sure. If you've been sunbaked and you're kind of, you know, starving and having to, you know, eat off on the side and trying to look at everyone there, like, you know, your mind tends to be off kilter after like 30 days on the island. When you're near the end, what was one of the hardest puzzles you had to deal with, or one of the hardest challenges you had to deal with, where your mind was just not there?
Challenges and competitions, or challenges and like the more broader sense of challenges?
I'm gonna say challenges and competitions.
I think that it's the stick-to-itiveness of a Survivor challenge which becomes the most difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are the individual immunity endurance challenges, which I knew I was never going to win, so I would just wait until like four or five people dropped out, then I would drop out. But I remember there was a puzzle at the end of Game Changers, and it was a word puzzle. It was for a reward challenge, and it would be the last challenge that I would win because I'd get voted out later that episode. And it was this big word scramble, and what people had realized, they'd realized the same thing that you realized, that if I was on the puzzle, I was going to win. And the other tribe kind of had given up. Like, it was this long word scramble. We'd been out there for an hour, and like, I just, like, nobody wants to exert that much mental effort, because you're with a word scramble, like, you know the number of word, the letters it's going to be, and you have to count it out, and you're like, what could it be? Or I think we've got something, and you realize like you're completely off, and you have to go back to it again. And I think it's that desire to keep going, to make your brain keep thinking longer, that's the hardest part, because you just want to be like, I give up, like, a pizza's not worth it, just let me go back to camp, just get me the fuck out of here. But you have to stick it out until it's mm-hmm. done.
You're like, it's like, I need that pizza, the next challenge will be harder, damn it, I want some of that grease. It's like, I miss New York.
Well, yeah, I think there's also the, like, you know that you don't get, like, you're not in control of when you leave. You leave when the puzzle's done.
Oh, jeez.
Right? Like, there's no, like, I quit, oh, I give man. Up. Like, that, you can't do that. Not only would they not let you do that, also, if you did that, you know, 9 months later when you're watching it back, you're going to be like, you asshole, you could have just finished the damn puzzle.
Did you watch any of your, like, did you watch the show week to week, or did you, were you of the mind, it's like, I've been there, I don't want to relive it, I lived it myself.
Well, that's the thing, is you, of course you watch it, because part of, like, the fun of being on a reality show is that everyone around you rallies around you, everyone's excited that their friend is on TV. So every week I had people over to my apartment, and we had, you know, dinner and drinks, smoked a bunch of pot, and watched Survivor. And, but you watch it, like, with bated breath, because before, I was just a big fan of this game of social strategy, so I always watch it for the strategy and be tracking the relationships. Mm-hmm. And me and my friends, we talk about it for hours. I listen to a Survivor podcast, but this time you're watching, it's like, all right, what dumb thing did I say? Like, what shot of me looking really fat are they going to use? Like, right? Like, you're just like, or I think you're also like, oh, I know in this episode, I got this person to talk to this person, and will I get credit, or will this other person get credit, and how many confessionals am I going to get? You're more just watching it for, like, what you and your character do. But yeah, I would watch it all back up until I got voted out. And after I got voted out, like, I didn't watch anymore.
What is the jury, I'm going to say, process like? Like, it's only up to a certain point. Like, okay, you've got dozens of contestants, and then a bunch get eliminated, and then it's like, okay, well, now you're on the jury. You get chosen, so you're like one of the final contestants. And you said that you go to Ponderosa.
Yes.
Now, what is Ponderosa like?
So Ponderosa in Fiji, it was the same place both times, is sort of like a sea level resort. So it's enough that you have, like, a bed where the sheets are changed and clean, and you have air conditioning, and you have a shower that works, probably not gonna get hot water. And then you have all the food and booze that you want.
Oh,
and
nice.
Because here's the thing, it's like, you've been voted out. They need to get you now to do what you need to do, which is go to tribal council every night, or most every night, and then ultimately vote for a winner. Mm-hmm. And they know that you're upset that you got voted out. They know that you want to go home, but you don't get your phone back. You don't get your email back. So they just try to keep you, like, happy and placated, which means they want to just keep you drunk the entire time. And, you know, they'll download whatever. And it's very interesting. Most, sometimes there'll be day excursions. Like, they would take us out into mainland Fiji, but we were staying, like, and not in the tourist part of Fiji. We were staying in an industrial part of Fiji. So, like, a day excursion for us would be, like, a trip to McDonald's and the liquor store.
Oh, nice. Oh, that's awesome. It's like, yeah. Oh, fries. Oh, thank God.
But for the most part, like, everyone just gets drunk and enjoys each other's company and is not upset with one another. My first season, Chris, who was another player that I was responsible for voting out, he, like, was not happy with me and was sort of, like, all pouty and weird. But that is the only time I've seen any two players have beef with each other after. I didn't have beef with him. He had beef with me. But yeah, I think it's a lot of everyone is trying to play nice, but by the time you get on that plane to go back to the United States, like, you don't, like, once you get back to the mainland and you go through customs, people don't even say goodbye to each other. They're just like, I'm getting the fuck out of here. I'm going back to my family. I've got my phone. I'm going to check my email. Like, people need to get away from one another.
5,000 messages. God damn it.
It is. It's insane. It's, you know, for me too, because I played back to back. So, like, I was basically gone for 4 months, and I had 4 months worth of emails and text messages and all of it, and came home so utterly destroyed as a human being. Just because Survivor's a really tough game, and everything that had happened and everything that lay ahead of me. And I was like, I've lived in the jungle for 4 months. I'm not really ready to go back to being a regular citizen.
That was one of the things that you at least I mentioned on, or not mentioned, but I read on the Wikipedia fan page that this is Coco. She's the official co-host. You're late.
You're late, Coco. You're almost done.
We're almost done. That it's like, what is one skill you picked up? And it's like, well, I can, you know, bring a salad to a friend's party and sit in a corner and just look at people while I'm eating. Just...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because between seasons, mm-hmm. I was back in Brooklyn for 2 weeks. And so I wanted to spend time with my friends. But also, Survivor is all about catering to the needs of other people. Mm-hmm. And you're never alone. And I had 2 weeks to like... not have to cater to other people, but you're a human being, so you also have to cater to other people. And I went to my friends' parties and I brought the food that I wanted to eat, and I would sit in the corner because I didn't want to talk to anybody. And I went to my friends' parties as a crazy person. It was, you know, it was maybe not the best moment of my life.
I'm trying to think of one.
Coco, you're showing me your ass quite a bit, and I'm not here to judge, you know, anyone's expression of their sexuality, but you know, it's a lot. It's a lot for a stranger.
No, the way that she usually does it to me, and when I was in my old studio and I was sitting in that chair, she would just jump on and she would just go, "Hold me."
Aww.
And it's like I just sit there and I just rub her this way, and everyone's like, "Oh, the cat." And then after a while, everyone's like, "Oh, the cat's there." And there was a couple of episodes she actually had her own camera where, like, I had a bed next to mine. It's like a Coco cam, you know, the official. But yeah, she does that. That's Bean.
Come on. Well, she looks great on camera. She looks very cute.
Oh, she's adorable. She really likes you.
Well, we just met. This is the first time we've interacted.
She's like, "You are mine now."
Tyson. He was Tyson, right?
Tyson, yes.
Yes, okay.
Tyson likes people. She's showing dominance right now. She is like, "You are mine. This couch is mine." And
I'm going to put my tail in your face.
Pretty much. Okay, well, again, another moment of levity here, because we've got about 13 or so minutes. I'm going to say 15 minutes. She's purring. Yeah, she really likes you. Going into the paranormal.
Sure.
You ever see a UFO out on the island? What weird shit have you seen, like, off in the distance? Any flashing lights, anything like that?
I have to say, I'm sort of lacking in experience with the paranormal, personally. We did see some flashing lights out in the distance. I do not know to what those are attributable. But I don't know. I feel like it to some extent... This is you're just putting your ass in my face, Kat.
This is just too much.
Like, it's not that I haven't licked an asshole in my day, but I've never licked a cat asshole. I will say that.
Ah, come here, Bean. Come here. No, she's not happy. She's like, no, no.
We were friends.
More pets. Okay, now you can stay with me. It's okay. Okay. Creative writing.
Sure. Yeah. Let's talk about writing. Something like UFOs. Writing. Yes.
So not much in terms of UFO. Yeah. So that's you were the third pop culture person who said like, nope, no UFOs. What is your writing like?
Sure. Well, I do a couple of different sorts of writing. I mentioned earlier, I have a comedy background, and my goal is to ultimately write for television. Mm-hmm. However, I think the writing that I'm most well known for is my prose. It's my personal essays, which is sort of the writing I did in response to what happened on Survivor. Creatively, writing a personal essay, it's like taking a hammer to your brain. For me, at least, it's like taking a hammer to your brain and like slamming it against your skull until something pours out. It's tremendously difficult for me to talk about personal topics. I'm a jokester. I use comedy to deflect and to not like fall into my feelings, but writing personal essays is all about determining what your own personal emotional arc is. It's a hard thing to do, I think. It's a hard thing to write about yourself. At least that's hard for me. But before I like wrote heartfelt personal essays to try to inspire the masses, I wrote like pretty naughty, dirty comedy videos, which Ooh. I like produced and directed myself. And I used to have this like great YouTube channel of all these like weird videos that I'd done in a couple of different web series. But when you decide to go on Survivor, they do this like scrub of your social media. They look at all your Twitter, all your Instagram, YouTube, whatever, anything connected to you. And then they send you a list of everything that you have to delete.
Oh my God.
And for me, half of my jokes on Twitter and essentially all of my, I would say almost all of the digital comedy that I'd done was had to be taken down.
Man, if they did that to me, I'd be like, I'm going to make some poor sob's life very, very difficult. Because it's like, okay, so 3 years of your life, remove that. I'm like, oh, fuck.
It was, yeah. Yeah, especially because, you know, I went on television hoping that it might do something, you know, to help me, like, comedically or artistically. And that, like, my whole body of work had to be removed and will and has to stay down, cannot be put back online for another like year, essentially, is pretty rough. But you know, it gives me, you know, the comedy writing that is taught at the Upright Citizens Brigade, which was like, you know, my artistic home for many years, is all sketch comedy writing. And the big distinction between sketch comedy writing and, say, sitcom writing is that sketch comedy writing is solely about the comedy, and it's about establishing and repeating patterns. There's no narrative to it. There's no sense of story. It's like on SNL. You see a bunch of different comedic scenes. Whereas a sitcom tells a story. It has an emotional arc. It has different beats. And I actually am a little bit better at narrative writing than I was at sketch comedy writing. So, I don't know. I guess it's a clean slate to some extent.
Am I going to have, like, CBS executives after my ass after this? It's like, you have to take that thing down to Zeke. I'm like, you could sue me, but...
No, you'll be fine.
Okay,
no one cares.
Thank God. Okay.
Look, here's the deal. I had to do so much press in the wake of everything. I know my P's and Q's. I haven't said anything that I'm not allowed to say.
Okay.
If I did, then we would talk about it, but I guess we're live, so it doesn't matter. But no, you're fine.
This is coming in from Craig. It's like, remember in Lost near the end where they got rescued and they thought they were like the surviving six or something like that? And then the spoiler alert, I bet post-survivor life feels like Matrix. Or like feels fake, like the Matrix.
Yeah, no, post-survivor life is tough because you are taken to the other side of the world and spend a month meeting strangers and having the most insane, amazing experience of your life, where you're living on an island and living through cyclones and going on challenges and voting people out, and it's very real, and the friendships you make are very real, and then you go home and you're separated from those people, and... You know, you're not allowed technically to talk about what happened, but you go home and you certainly tell your friends and your family what happened, but they don't know who these people are. None of what you tell them seems real. There's no way that they can connect to you. So it does, Survivor in many ways does feel like this odd fever dream, especially because the opportunity that they will have to connect to you is only what they see on television. But what they see on television is 42 minutes directed towards serving one of two narratives. So the first narrative is who is the sole survivor, and the second narrative is the episodic narrative, which is who gets voted out tonight. So a lot of what happens out there that feels tremendously important doesn't make it because it doesn't serve one of those two narratives, even though at the, like, you know, each episode is filmed over 48 to 72 hours. So something important might happen in that time period that doesn't make the show because it doesn't serve a narrative.
Now, speaking of narratives, can you give me an idea of your writing process?
Sure. I write by writing. So which is just to say, I'm not an outliner. I'm not someone who can use note cards or think of beats. I will start to think of words in my brain, and I put those down on the page, and I just let it take over. So I started writing a new pilot a few days ago, and I had a sense of a character. I had a sense of that character's want. I knew the general world that they lived in, and I started writing. And as I wrote, other characters entered his world, and he went different places. And that's how I discovered things about him. And through that process of discovery, I was able to distill what ultimately the piece will be about. And then I have to write a new draft. I mean, nothing I wrote. Well, not that this pilot will go anywhere, but if it does, nothing of the like 50 pages I wrote will ultimately make a polished draft that someone else will see.
Now, obviously, we can't talk about the pilot because it's still out there. What are kind of the besides Big Bang Theory, which we talked about? what is your big? I'm gonna say like what is the big success and obstacle now? Like, how have you been able to overcome that obstacle?
Writing wise.
More writing wise, creative wise, like in terms of what you do.
Right. The biggest obstacle, I think, is for me, was showing people my work. Getting it out there, getting feedback, and being afraid of judgment and criticism. Mm-hmm. And the difficult part about that is unless you are letting other people interact with your work, you have no sense of it. Like for me, I personally, when I write something, I have no idea whether it's good or it's bad, objectively. All I see are the words that were once in my brain now on the page. I have to give it to someone else to know if it's good or if it's bad, if it's connecting or if it's clear. And I wasn't doing that. And since I wasn't doing it, I wasn't getting any feedback on my writing, so I wasn't writing. So for me, I had to put structure into my writing life in order to propel myself forward. So I have accountability deadlines. Mm. I have a person who every 2 weeks I am obligated to send at least 10 pages to. I have to. I mean, I guess I could not, but that defeats the purpose. But yeah, it's establishing that structure where I have to write. Because if I don't have to write, I won't write. I love to write. But it's writing is painful.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, especially when you're like in that mode of shit, I don't like this paragraph. You move the paragraph around. You're like, okay, I'm going to put this to the end for now. And then you're like, okay, cool. This is great. Then you realize after you sent it to your editor or whatever, you're like, fuck, I left the paragraph in. It shouldn't be in there. And you're like, can you not publish that?
Yeah, but no, but I think there is something into that. I feel like when you're working on something, if you're the only eyes that have ever been on it, then it all just blends together. Or you know how it's supposed to sound in your mind. So you're not actually reading the words on the page. You have your internal narrative playing back to you, and it's not until you release it out to someone else, I feel like, that I have any ability to look back at what I wrote or to see it objectively. Like for me, it's all goo until I send it in an email to someone else, and then I look back at it and I'm like, oh, you asshole, that was terrible and that sucks, but that's pretty good. Or no, you need to totally like redo this. Or like I'll get feedback and I'm like, yeah, now I see it, but it didn't become clear to me until, I don't know, I let the universe take a look at it. I don't know, it's very weird. I'm not a spiritual person except when it comes to writing, and then I get all sorts of like weird.
Okay, now the last two questions I have, this one's related to your creativity.
Sure.
What is your ultimate, like, what is your biggest ideal, and how are you working to get there?
My biggest goal?
Well, biggest goal, like, okay.
So, like, what I want is I want to be a showrunner. So, I want to create a television show, ideally a half-hour comedy. Not like a sitcom like Big Bang Theory, but probably something more like Silicon Valley or Veep. Hmm. That is, like, it's funny, but it also, like, tells a narrative. So, I want to be the showrunner. So, I want to have created it, and then I want to be the person who runs that writer's room and is in charge of the creative direction of the show. I think that's my like 5 to 10 year goal. I think like the bigger goal though is to have my own production company where I not only can make what I want to make, but also have the ability to green light other people's visions, have my own media empire.
That is absolutely fantastic. Now, for the main thing, like, have you spec'd this out in terms of business plan, or it's just kind of like, when I get to that moment, I'll know and then I'll do it, or is this like, what is the path you see there?
Well, I think the first, I think the first goal is you have to. It is definitely possible to go to start as a creator, like someone like Lena Dunham started as a creator. Though I think we would all love to like hop into the business the way she does. That's a little less realistic. So I think for me, the first step is becoming a staff writer, like becoming a television writer. And then from there, selling my own show and becoming a showrunner. So I think it's, you know, those are huge steps, right? Those are lifetime goals for a lot of people. And I think that's like, get there and then get to the next step. And for me, I have to, it's all about like compartmentalizing. Mm-hmm. So if I start looking at like the big picture, I'm be like, there's no way in hell I know how to run my own media empire. Of course there's not. Like, I have no fucking clue. So I don't worry about that. We know that's the long-term thing. It's out there. We'll deal with that when it's time to deal with that. Let's focus and like, you know, pour myself wholeheartedly into the more immediate like 5 year goal. I'd say 2 to 5 year. Well, 1 to 5 year goal.
Fantastic. Now we're at the almost at the top of the hour. And the last thing I'm going to say is, what would you like to say to the people out there as a message, in terms of positive message to those who seek a role model, you know, as a somebody who may be transitioning, or, you know, to aspiring writers, potential Survivor contestants?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think it's be your own damn role model, right? Because you have to be, don't look to other people for permission or direction. Mm. You have a sense of where you want to go in life. You have a vision. You have goals and you have values. Somewhere deep inside you is a clear understanding of who you want to be when you grow up, right? Because you and I, we're both still growing up, right? We have that idea, both career-wise and success-wise and family-wise, but also like an idea of the person we want to be, the type of character we are. Mm-hmm. Let that drive you. Don't listen to the voices around you. Because before I went on Survivor, there are so many people who told me not to do it, so many people who told me I was going to fail. I knew that I had my goal, I knew I had my way I wanted to do it, and I knew that if something went wrong, I knew how I was going to respond. And I let my best version of myself lead me out there, and it got me where I wanted to. And that was an approach to life I didn't take before Survivor. I listened to everybody else. I listened to all the doubters, and I let their doubt tell me I was limited. And when I took their doubt away, when I stopped telling myself I was limited, I started getting where I wanted to be in life.
That's awesome. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is the end of the show. Zeke, let's go cook some steaks.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. And I'm going to play the outro music for you, which is... you know, I'm going to play Spellbound. You know, Spectrum. I like some drum and bass. I always play Spectrum.
Fantastic. Well, this space porn was awesome. I definitely got off many times.
Oh, man. I'm still getting off on that.
Oh, good.
We'll look at some videos afterwards.
Excellent.
It's okay. Space chickens in space. May their blue plumage be upon you, etc. And sometimes in more than one place. Ladies and gentlemen, next week on the show on Friday, our usual time, 8 p.m. or 8:30, depending on if we start a little bit late. Let's see, is this next week's segment? I think that's... I can't read it from there, so we'll try this out here next. Nope, that's not. There we go, next week's segment. I'm going to shrink that down a little bit. Ladies and gentlemen, next week on the show, we've got a double feature. Make that a little larger. The screen's 20 feet away from me, so... So next week on the show, we've got Robert Pavol for our one-year anniversary show, continuing our madness that is Den of Lore 1 year. And not only that, we also do have our patron masterclass with George Howard. We're going to be talking about the Carolina Bays, Younger Dryas, Comet Impact. That will be live and interactive for all of our masters. So if you are not a master so far, go to patreon.com/Den of Lore. That's lore with an E, because I know it's missing on the graphic because Photoshop sucks when it comes to fonts, making fonts bold. So go check that out now. Support the show, support the program, and please do tune in next Friday. We've got tons of potential people calling in. They're calling it the biggest show ever, live here in the Den of Lore, Friday nights, September 29th. Check it out. Until then, ladies and gents, peace out.